You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Eric Herm thought he'd never return to the West Texas cotton farm he'd been raised on after he graduated from college. Yet, after a decade of writing poetry and other things and traveling throughout the United States, Mexico, Europe, and North Africa, he felt compelled to return to the land that had been in his family for four generations and nearly a century. His new book, Surviving Ourselves, The Evolution of Community Education and Agriculture of the 21st Century, is about the vital relationship between humans and nature. It's published by Dream River Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Eric Herm back to our show. Hi.
Thanks for having me again, Leonard.
The last time you were here was to talk about your book about growing up on the farm. Mm-hmm. This time you're talking about what you've learned as a farmer.
Yeah, it's not only my observations and lessons, but several people that I've met along the way who are changing things for the better and different aspects.
You describe Ackerley, Texas, the town near your family's cotton farm, as very small. How small are we talking?
300 people, roughly, yeah.
So what did that mean when you went to school?
It means you knew everybody and everybody knew you. So you better watch what you do because you had a lot of eyes out there that everything would get back to your parents.
Well, how many kids in your class?
In my class, there were 20 in our graduating class.
Is everybody in the area engaged in cotton farming?
For the most part, not near as many now as there was 20 years ago or so when I was growing up.
So what does that mean? A cotton farm is quite different than other kinds of farms, isn't it?
Yeah, we tend to have more acres on cotton farming, and particularly where we are because it's such an arid climate. A lot of years we don't have a crop. Like the last 2 years, we've had no cotton crop, and so crop insurance is a major way we survive economically.
And is there a special kind of soil required for growing cotton?
I've always said that cotton, if it were a man, I would not want to fight it because it's the toughest plant I've ever seen. It can take a beating. It's very drought tolerant, can grow in sandy or any type of soil structure. I mean, it needs to be aired out, you know, and that real boggy soil doesn't do well.
And West Texas is on the edge of the desert, isn't it?
Yeah, I say it's where the desert gave birth to the prairie or vice versa, however you look at it.
So how did you feel about farm life when you were growing up?
I didn't want to be there. A lot of the time, I liked the freedoms that I had as a child, but as I got older in my teen years, I just wanted to get out of there because I was so bored and wanted to do different things, see different things.
But wasn't the work also difficult?
Yes, a lot of work. A lot of my friends that were out enjoying their summer times, and summertime was probably my least favorite because that's when all my work happened.
And when you decided to leave the farm to travel and write, what was your family's reaction?
Awkward silence at first. They were not real happy, but I worked in different fields in the broadcast journalism field for a few years before I kind of became a nomad, and nobody really knew how to take that in my family.
Well, how did your travels shape your perspective on life?
It opened up my eyes to there's so many different ways to achieve something. Where often we get caught up in our own culture and our own, especially in a small town, you think there's only one way to do it because that's the way everybody else is doing it. Well, you find out there's other ways that you can go about achieving something, and sometimes maybe that means harder work. But I found in other countries and other places just how much happier they were when the food was really so much more part of their lives.
So is that what inspired you to go back to the farm?
Not really. It still took me a few more years to really get back there, and I just wanted to come back. I felt it was time. My dad's parents were in bad health, and I wanted to get back and help him out for just a little bit. And then the farm just grabbed hold of me, and I knew that that's where I needed to be.
How long had you been away?
About 8 or 9 years.
So had the way agriculture was being done changed much in the years
big time.
Since you left?
Yeah, big time. Tractors have gotten bigger. We're farming more acres than ever. More chemicals than ever.
And GMOs?
GMO crops had moved in.
Does cotton have GMO crops?
Absolutely. 90% of cotton is genetically modified.
And they weren't being used before you left the farm?
No. Never heard of it.
As you see it, how does that affect the land itself?
What I see now is more soil degradation than ever. I see more weed issues than ever. The weeds are becoming resistant to the glyphosate, the active ingredient in Roundup.
But I thought that Roundup was developed to get rid of weeds.
That was the idea, but
so this is like a bacterial infection. We develop antibiotics, and then
exactly.
The bacteria adjust.
You got it. And weeds and insects, they're survivors. They always find a way. They mutate, and they overcome whatever it is that's killing them. And that's what's happening.
Well, there are people who are concerned about whether HMOs actually affect us and the animals that consume them. But there's been no proof that they have an adverse effect.
Well, you go back to the 90s when Arpad Pusz died, who was the foremost genetic researcher in the world at that time. He did a two-year study with rats saying it led to cancer rates, spleen damage, liver atrophy, all sorts of things. And now they're finding out it's difficult to come out with accurate studies because there's no labeling of GMOs still. And so everybody's eating them more or less for the most part. And they're being linked to neurological disorders such as ADHD and autism in children, which the rates parallel each other from the early 90s till now, whenever that started hitting the shelves.
Well, does it matter for a cotton farmer? We don't eat cotton.
It's still on your body. When you think of cotton, you think of just this idea or concept of purity. It always has been a symbol of purity, but it's more chemicals than ever are now used on it. You know, they'll advertise it as something you'll use less pesticides, but they're bombarding it with more poisons than ever.
And in your estimation, how has this approach to the farm industry affected the quality of soil and water?
I think it's decimating it. There's no doubt in my mind it's decimating it.
Well, many people complain about the development of the monocultures in agriculture, but you had a cotton farm. That was a monoculture, wasn't it?
Yes. When I moved back, we pretty much only farmed cotton, but we've rotated in other crops. I've grown sunflowers, wheat, oats. We've got a cover crop on over 50% of our acres now, even despite the drought. That's oats, rye, a tillage radish, and a winter legume.
And what happens when you do that sort of thing? Do your neighbors look at you like you're being weird?
Of course. Yeah, I'm always the strange bird in the flock, you know, doing things a little bit differently, and they always question it. But my concepts are always based on the fact of improving the health of the soil, which will improve our crops and improve everything else around it.
Well, cotton is famous for depleting the nutrients in the soil, isn't it? So that means you had to use a lot of fertilizers?
It's famous because it's been such an intense monoculture. Like, that's the only crop that most guys plant in our region because it grows well due to drought conditions.
See, I always thought that cotton was from the South, and that's that was tied to slavery and all the other problems in the 19th century history of the United States. But West Texas as well?
Yes. West Texas was settled so much later than everywhere else in the country. I mean, really not until the early 1900s were there agriculture in the area. But you've got history of cotton, what it's shown us even in Enterprise, Alabama, where they had the statue for the boll weevil. They realized that when they started rotating in other crops such as peanuts or anything else they could grow, that the boll weevil disappeared. And yet we've still failed to learn that lesson decades later.
So you have problems with boll weevils in West Texas?
The method of treating the boll weevil now is an intensive statewide mandated program that's used with pesticides. But the boll weevil has been under control for the most part now, recently.
But if you decided you didn't want to participate, you'd have no choice in the matter?
You have no choice in the matter.
My guest is Eric Herm, H-E-R-M. His latest book, Surviving Ourselves, The Evolution of Community Education and Agriculture in the 21st Century. It is published by Dream River Press. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Eric Herm, who is a farmer, a naturalist, and activist. He was raised on a cotton farm near Ackerley, Texas, and is back there. He has written about his experiences in a book called Son of a Farmer, Child of the Earth, which was published a couple of years ago. And now he's written Surviving Ourselves, The Evolution of Community Education and Agriculture in the 21st Century. It is published by Dream River Press. In November, last month,
yeah.
California had Proposition 37 on the ballot, and it would have required the labeling of all foods containing GMOs in the state. Don't many countries require GMO labels. China, Saudi Arabia, South Korea, Japan, Australia, Russia, India, Chile. What happened in California?
It was voted down. I believe it was about 55% to 45% it failed. And so, yeah, there's about 50 countries worldwide that have mandatory labeling or have banned GMOs altogether.
Were you surprised when the ballot initiative failed?
I was slightly surprised, but when you consider Monsanto and friends, the other food companies spent between $50 and $70 million in advertising the last few weeks to bombard the television and radio waves, it wasn't too surprising.
Well, that's a lot of money. Why are those corporations so opposed to labeling?
Because it would be a thorn in their side, and it's sort of a, I don't want to say the nail in the coffin for them, but it would definitely be something that draw attention when people pick up food and they have the choice now of GMOs or not GMOs. You have that to be able to look at the label and see. Now we still have no idea what you're eating.
While he was campaigning for the first time in 2007, Barack Obama promised to have legislation drafted for the required labeling of all GMO foods. What happened to that? Did it ever come up again?
It has been brought to his attention several times. I was with several others that marched from Brooklyn to the White House last year. We had a rally outside. Since he's been in office, though, he's appointed Michael Taylor, basically who was the food czar in this country, who was a Monsanto employee for 20-plus years. You've got Secretary of Agriculture Vilsack, formerly of Iowa, who had very strong ties to Monsanto and other biotech companies. We're not making any progress, it seems, in the White House or in our Senate.
How much of the food that we eat do you estimate has GMO in it?
You talk about snack foods and processed foods, you're looking at 80%. And then anything that has corn, canola, soy, and you take in the fact that most livestock are fed those crops, so your beef, your chicken, all that, 90% of those crops are genetically modified.
Should I assume that the corn I buy at the green market during the summer is also a GMO product?
I would ask the person who's growing it. If you're buying it from the farmers or if they're getting it from farmers directly, people need to start asking questions about their food. Talk to people at your restaurants, supermarkets. We need to get more involved publicly. Everyone needs to get involved in this fight.
You outline in this book many ideas that you feel can help bring about leading to beneficial changes or lasting beneficial changes to our current agricultural system and society as a whole, such as improving education about nature. Do you think that Americans don't know enough about nature?
Absolutely, we don't know enough. Especially these days, we're so far removed not only from the farm but from nature. Kids, they're spend most of their time in the classrooms, but they don't really get outside much, especially in urban areas.
But in New York, we're seeing more and more schools actually with gardens, with little farms, and they've expanded from the playgrounds to the roofs of mm-hmm. many of these schools. So are we seeing things change?
I think so, in small pockets. They're happening here and there, but it needs to be more widespread. And the people who are leading this charge, I think, should be definitely the examples we need to follow.
Although when Alice Waters suggests some of these things, she's labeled an elitist.
Well, we all get called all kinds of things whenever you put yourself out front.
What are eco-villages and transition towns?
It's basically places that are popping up that are living in more harmony environmentally, economically. Everything becomes more about the community around themselves, and they follow it, whether it's harvesting rainwater or creating a local food economy or just trying to work through a barter system with each other.
And where are these things popping up?
They are all over here and there. There's some in Tennessee. I know that there's one in Missouri just north of St. Louis. They're worldwide. There's a lot more in India and South America than there are in the United States.
Well, if I really wanted to live a purer life, mm-hmm. how much of an opportunity would I have? If, for example, I don't know whether I'm eating things that have things that were grown through with HMOs in them, whether it's my breakfast cereal or, as you say, the meat I eat or the dairy or whatever. So I can't do much about it, can I?
Sure you can. I mean, like I said, it starts with education and awareness and starting from there. And I believe it's really important to create a core group around you of people who are more skilled or more enlightened in different areas, and we all help each other in that way.
But so much of the discussion comes down to politics. For example, what are your thoughts about the deadlock over the latest farm bill?
It's not surprising. What we're seeing is we have fewer and fewer friends in Congress as far as agriculture goes, and there's more friends with the biotech companies and other large food corporations.
But aren't there a lot of farm states? How come you don't have friends from all those farm states?
We do have friends, but what we run into is you have the corn lobbyists jockeying for position for the corn growers. You have the cotton lobbyists jockeying position. There's not really anybody that's looking out for the betterment of agriculture as a whole.
And those corn lobbyists, I mean, those cotton lobbyists are not looking out for your betterment?
For the most part, but it's hard to say. When I represent probably less than 10% in organic farmers, cotton farmers, we represent less than 1% of the population. We don't really have that voice for us.
Can you charge more for your cotton because you are growing it organically?
Yes.
What changes did you make on the way that you farm?
Much more labor intensive. On 250 acres that I'm now organically certified, there's no chemicals. We do all of our weeding by implements and by hand.
Would your grandfather be surprised?
Yeah. Yeah, some people think I'm probably taking a few steps backwards.
But you probably are growing in ways more like what your great-grandfather did.
Yes, yeah.
So by going backward, you feel we're going forward?
I think so. I mean, I'm not one of those that's completely against technology or progression. I think we have to take advantage of what methods we do have in technology and implement those with some of the old ways.
Are you the only one in your area who's doing this sort of thing? Are there other farmers who've joined you?
Well, there's about 20 to 25 organic cotton farmers in Texas that I'm a part of, the Texas Organic Cotton Co-op, and they've been doing this for 20 years, and they're really the leaders in this industry, the real pioneers that have really created this whole new market and a healthier way to farm.
If Texas secedes, you think that the, as it's threatening to, do you think that the new government will be in support of your ideas?
I don't know who would be running the show at that point.
Well, you know, the South seceded partly because of King Cotton. Maybe Texas can as well. So did your whole family work on the farm?
Yes.
Just like you did when you were a kid?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the plan. I got two boys, so I'm ready to get them to work any opportunity I can.
Will you be surprised if one of them says, you know, Dad, I think after I graduate from school, I'm going to want to travel for a while?
Yeah, I'll say I don't blame you.
How hard is it for you to get away from the farm? Here you are in New York.
Unfortunately, now it's not near as hard with 2 years in a row with no cotton crop to harvest. I've got more spare time on my hands than normal.
If you were using the other methods, would you have had more of a cotton crop?
No. No, I can show you pictures.
It's just the drought?
The drought's hit us very hard, but I can show you pictures where our crop was hanging in there longer than our neighbors who farmed with the Roundup Ready cotton.
And this drought may wind up lasting for quite a while. What are your contingency plans?
Well, I say that, you know, some years you say a prayer, some years you take a shot of tequila, and some years you may drink more tequila than you say prayers, but next year is always the best year you're ever going to have in farming, and so you stay an optimist.
I'm informed that I said HMO instead of GMO.
Yeah, GMO.
I guess I was, because I was thinking about all the medical problems that people right. have after they've been eating this other stuff, although it is not, you say it's been proven, but if I brought in somebody from Monsanto or from one of the other people involved. Kraft, for example, was one of the corporations that fought that proposition in California. They might disagree with you.
Oh, yeah, they're going to disagree. And that's usually when you have a dog and your dog in the fight is going to disagree with my dog in the fight, because it's going to make things a little bit more difficult for those food companies. And it's certainly going to be a thorn in the side for biotech companies like Monsanto.
Eric Herm's book is Surviving Ourselves, The Evolution of Community Education and Agriculture in the 21st Century. It is published by Dream River Press. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thanks for having me, Leonard.